Hello and welcome to Table Talk. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Nora Prendergast.
Today we are delighted to be joined by Kate Young. Kate is a food writer and chef. Her first book, The Little Library Cookbook, was published in 2017 and combined Kate's love of books and reading with cooking, featuring 100 recipes for dishes from Kate's favourite works from fiction. Her new book, The Little Library Year, follows 12 months of combined seasonal reading and eating. Kate, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you.
Kate, you grew up in Australia. What was food like when you were younger?
Very good. My parents are both very good cooks, and my grandmother's a very good cook, and my late grandmother, my dad's mother, is also a very good cook, all in quite different ways, but there was a lot of food in my house.
And the where food exactly was very in good. Australia? Where are you?
In Brisbane, which is about halfway up the East Coast, for anyone who doesn't know it. It is quite tropical, so we've got lots of really good fruit, lots of really good seafood, lots of really nice, fresh, you know, produce year round. It's a really beautiful, lovely place to grow up. Every time I go back, I have a big list of things that I'm going to eat while I'm there because they do taste better there.
And what are the kind of classic dishes that you grew up eating?
I grew up eating a lot of things with mango because there's a lot of mango. So mango sorbet, mango ice cream, mango in salads, mango basically in everything. Ate a lot of seafood. We had a lot of prawns, we had a lot of fish, we do grilled fish a lot, and my parents would barbecue really frequently. We both had both my parents, they lived separately, they split up when I was five, but they both had barbecues on their back deck, and so really frequently that's how we'd cook dinner. So whether it was sausages or grilled vegetables or burgers or whatever else, we'd do something on the barbecue.
And at what stage did you become interested in cooking? Because you learnt from your family, really.
I did, yeah, and I think probably really early on. I can't remember not helping out, not being a part of it. I think as well, my mum being a single mum for a few years when I was sort of between the ages of five, and I think she and my stepdad married when I was 11. So there was a big chunk of time when there were really just three girls in the house, me and my mum and my little sister. And so we cooked a lot, we helped out a lot, we were always involved in the cooking. And I think not only because it was a nice way to keep us in the same room as her and doing something with her, but also it was helpful and useful to have us around. And it meant that I, you know, by the time I got to school and was doing home economics in school and was cooking at school, I had already been cooking for years and years with mum.
I mean, we normally ask people what school food was like, and they're normally talking about sort of classic English dishes. What's Australian school food like?
Well, we don't have the sort of same culture of school dinners. I brought my lunch to school in a lunchbox every day. We had a school tuck shop where you could get ice cream or a meat pie or any sort of daily specials. I think we had chicken burgers was a famous thing that we used to have. But I took a packed lunch almost every day. My mum's sandwiches are fantastically good.
Tell us about your mum's sandwiches and your sister.
Yeah, so my mum's sandwiches are fantastically good. She makes really great salad sandwiches where she'd sort of package everything separately so that by the time you get to lunchtime, it's not soggy.
So
that you get to reconstruct and the beetroot goes in and the tomato goes in and the stuff that would have made it soggy goes in late and the lettuce on the outside so that it, you know, buffers against the bread. It was really well thought out sandwiches. But my sister used to go, we found out at my sister's hen night just before she got married from one of her friends that she used to swap her sandwich for tuck shop money so she could go and buy a pie most days at school. So these great sandwiches my mum was making, her friend Michaela, that I write about and how wonderful they are, that Michaela was buying off Lucy with the promise of enough money for a meat pie.
Someone out there had some delicious sandwiches.
Someone, Michaela specifically, I know who had the delicious sandwiches.
And you lived at home whilst you were at university.
I did, which is a pretty common thing to do in Australia because there's lots of universities in the big... If you grow up in a big city, lots of people do. And I went to university sort of 15 minutes down the road from where I grew up.
So your first time living away from home was when you moved to London.
Literally
across the globe.
Yeah, I bought a one-way ticket the day I graduated university and flew out a couple of months later.
What made you want to do that?
I had wanted to move here since I was 12. I am mad and was totally obsessed with it. We won a trip over here when I was 12 years old. So we at our local shopping centre, we essentially won flights to come to the UK.
And you were born
I was
here.
Born here as well, here. Yes. So I was born here, so I always had the sort of flexibility of you've got a passport, you could come and spend 2 years here and love it, and stay, or you could come and spend 2 years here and then spend 2 years back in Australia and then come back again. I've got a flexibility here that lots of my other friends who moved here from Australia don't have. So I'm incredibly lucky. And so it always felt like a a thing that was very possible and very achievable. My parents lived here for 10 years during the 80s. They moved here in 79 and back to Australia with us in 89. And so, you know, it always felt like a thing that I would probably do.
And what did you find so enticing about London?
I wanted to work in theatre, first of all. And so having graduated from university, having studied theatre, it was the place in the world that made the most sense to move. The theatre's great. There's a really great education program in loads of subsidised theatres here. It felt like a really exciting place to be. But also, I just remember being here when I was 12 and thinking it was the most magical place. I read loads of English literature growing up, and coming over here kind of offered all of that to me. It felt like a place that I kind of knew already because it was familiar from books, even though obviously the books I was reading were sort of, I mean, The Secret Garden is not like England is now. So, I had a very warped view of what England might be and London might be, but it was certainly something that I came here looking for.
And what was the reality in the food sense, at any rate? What was it like when you first arrived?
I lived with two lads from university who are great, great people, and eventually another third one as well. We lived in this really grimy flat in Whitechapel on Commercial Road. And we lived across the road from a 24-hour McDonald's and above a restaurant called Lahore 2, which ironically was the first Lahore restaurant. I don't know why it was number two. And we had this sort of very electric blue carpet and a tiny kitchen with a bar fridge that the three of us shared. And so the food was kind of dependent on the fact that I only had one shelf in a tiny bar fridge. And so we cooked together a lot. We'd cook big meals. We'd invite our friends round. We ate a lot of meals sitting on our sofa because that was our communal shared space. And I was a teacher in far, far northwest London. So I was traveling an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes each way every day. And so I coming home and eating food was very much about what can I cook quickly and eat before I have to go to bed and get up tomorrow at 5:30 in the morning.
And when was it that you first started writing about food?
It was the beginning of 2014. Yeah, beginning of 2014. So it's been about 5.5 years now. Mm. I cooked a treacle tart because it's Harry Potter's favourite dessert and I'd never had one before. But it felt like it would be a comforting, homey thing. And it was the first experience I'd had of going, oh, I want to make that thing that's in that book, even though I've never tasted it before, because I'm sure it will be good if it's his favourite thing. And it was great. And I had friends to dinner and I sort of told them that story and they went, you should write about that. And I started a blog and I started posting a recipe a week, and I was quite strict with myself at that point. And I mean this not self-deprecatingly, but literally no one was reading it. But I was very strict with myself about, I need to put a recipe up a week because I need to commit to this thing. And I'm not sure why I was committing. I didn't want to leave theatre. I wasn't looking for a new career. It was just a nice creative project that was mine. I worked all day producing theatre and making other people's creative visions happen. And I wanted to do something that was my thing.
And how did you go about working out the Harry Potter recipe? I mean, there isn't obviously a recipe given in the book, but did you kind of piece together bits of information from the book?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at that stage as well, I was quite early on. And really what I wanted to do was just expand how much baking I was able to do. So I think if you look back, the first year of the blog is all sweet or savoury baking. It's in fact,
books.
I think it's sweet and it's mostly children's books. And it was very much looking at the time in which the book was written and trying to pull a recipe from somewhere that might work and trying out a bunch of different things and playing around with it and then coming up with something that I thought was good. And that is sort of a process that I've honed much more over the 5.5 years. Certainly in those early days, it was just like, well, what is a treacle tart? I will look up some recipes and read a bunch of them and look at what other people are putting in it and then think about what kind of pastry I like and what might go with, you know, the fact that it's a golden syrup sponge and should there be sugar in the pastry or not, and trying to think about all of those things.
And are there any dishes that you've found in a book and tried to recreate and they're just not possible?
There's a very specific dish in Iris Murdoch's The Sea, which is a poached egg inside scrambled eggs.
You tried, didn't you?
I did, for ages, and it's not a thing. There's a reason that that's not a thing we've heard of because it's awful. It basically,
either
end up with overcooked scrambled eggs or a raw poached egg. Because either way, like once you cook the scrambled eggs enough to cook a poached egg in it, you're essentially going to be overcooking the scrambled eggs or undercooking the poached egg. So either way, it's a failure and it's awful and just don't do it.
Is there a particular period that you find sort of most interesting in terms of literature and the recipes that come out of it?
I think... Interestingly, that the I really like mid-century literature generally, but I particularly like mid-20th century children's literature because it was released during rationing when kids didn't have access to things that they can now lay their hands to, and is written as a sort of wish fulfillment thing. So you have these extraordinary feasts described where you've got 20 different types of cake on a table in a way that just wouldn't have been happening in, you know, suburban kitchens around England. And I like reading about that and imagining being a child without that and how that literature might feed you in a way.
So tell us about how you ended up leaving your career in theatre for one in cookery.
So I left, I handed in my notice in mid-2015. So just over a year after I started the blog, which feels quite quick, really. But I did it because I wanted to open a cafe. That was the original plan, was that I was going to go and open the Little Library Cafe, which is what my blog was called, and have a coffee shop that was lined with books and where you... the cake of the day would be from a particular book, and I had this whole plan for it. And then I signed a book deal. And so this dream that I had, I sort of left work 6 months later. I gave them loads of notice and gave myself loads of buffer time because I was obviously panicking, going from a job that paid me to a job that was demonstrably not going to pay me for ages. So I gave them loads of notice. And then by the time I left, I'd started working with my now agent and we'd sent my book out. And then about 6 weeks after I finished work, we signed a book deal. So it kind of ended up happening much more easily than I had imagined that it might. And what I then did, knowing that I would be spending the next sort of year and a half writing a book, is that I got a job as a nanny working in a house in London, which meant that I could live in London for free and try out the recipes on the kids.
Kids must have loved that.
Yeah, it was great fun. I think they did. I think there are some recipes that they would quite happily never see again. There's a black sesame ice cream, and I remember Eli's face when he first tried that and how much he did not enjoy that experience.
It's a very good recipe.
It is a great recipe. I love
Eli
it.
Eli might not have liked it. It's very nice.
But I had to make it 7 times to get sort of the balance of different flavours right, because it is quite savoury and it is an ice cream and it needs to still work as an ice cream. But generally, on the whole, I think the kids had a really
what
fun time.
What were their favourite dishes?
The cream horns. Like 100%,
which are so difficult,
so difficult and bit, so fussy, and which as a person, like afterwards, I've never made since. They're from The Little White Horse, which I adore, and it's a great story. It's one of those like mid-century literature, children's literature, where there is literally a table of 20 different cakes. That is the book I was talking about when I said that. But I mean, we were making puff pastry for the shoot for the book in 30-degree heat in the middle of summer, standing in the fridge trying to roll out the pastry because it was so warm. And I just remember looking at Liv and going, like, why would anyone make their own puff pastry? Like, why? Why is that a thing that anyone's done? But that was the kids' favourite thing, and they wanted to make those all the time.
And I mean, had you done most of the reading of the various novels that you then included in the book, or did you have to then go and find the recipes that you were going to include?
It was a really interesting thing. Most of them, yes, I had read at some point before they made it to the final list. I think at one point for the first book, there was a list of about 250 books that I was going to include and 250 recipes. And then it was about making that list function as a cookbook, because although it's a great fun idea, I wanted it to work first and foremost as a cookbook you could pick up and actually make something out of. I didn't want it to be a quite twee coffee table book that is pretty to look at and includes lots of nice mentions of books but isn't something you'd ever use. I wanted it to be functional. And so what we very much had to do was go, what recipes actually work? You know, do we have too much meat in this chapter? Is there enough? Are there enough vegetables? Are there too many desserts? Are all of these recipes too complicated? Are some of them too simple? So it was very much about making the structure work as a cookbook. And then I went back and reread all of the books as well. So although I had read most of them before, I was reading constantly in the lead up to like finalizing that list, and then ended up sort of rereading most of them anyway to make sure I knew what I was talking about.
And tell us about the difference between the first book and your new book, The Little Library Year.
So the first book was this collection of 100 recipes, and all of them are very directly taken from the book that they are mentioned in. So each page starts with a quote, and each recipe then follows on from that quote, recreating what you see in that book. That was a wonderful but slightly restrictive way of doing the first book, because obviously you're completely bound by the meals that these characters are having. And I found myself sort of wishing that people were slightly more creative with the meals they were putting on a table, so that I could be slightly more creative with what I was making. And when I came to writing the second book, I knew that I wanted very much to have that same sense of literature throughout, but I wanted to give myself a chance to be a bit more creative with the recipes. And so each small section, there's sort of, gosh, I should know this number off by heart, but I think there's 36 little sections through the book. And those 36 little sections are broken down into 6 2-month seasons throughout the year. So sort of separating it all down that way. And each of those starts with a quote and then has 3 or 4 recipes that follow on from it that work within that season or that mood or from that book or whatever it is. So it's a little less restrictive, and I've found that a really wonderful process. And I think as well that it means that the recipes are better and richer and more interesting, because I've found myself less bound by the constraints I set myself for book one.
And it's also looking at which books you should read seasonally.
Absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for selling my book for me. Yeah. So it is, yes, it is very much about what's the right time of year to be reading Anna Karenina, or what's the right time of year to be reading Talented Mr. Ripley, and then looking at scary books for October when Halloween comes, and back to school books for September, and books about English gardens in April and May. So it is about what is that mood like in those months, and what might you want to do.
And how important do you think food is for a book? I mean, you've said before that you don't trust books that don't have food in them.
I did say that, and I stand by that. I think it is so important, because it is something that we do every day. We all do it. We all eat. And whether it's a really important part of your life or not, it is a sort of like biological imperative that you have to put food in front of yourself and then consume it at some point during a day. And it gives you a sense, I think, of who characters are and how their family functions and what their class is and where they sit and how much they value time spent together and how much they value food as an entity and what they want to do and want to eat and how they want to spend their money and their time. And I think it tells you an enormous amount. And it also provides an enormous amount of mood and atmosphere. And I think it's... But the books that I really love, I think, do it really, really well. And I hadn't quite realised until I'd started this process how much that is true and how much I felt like I'm straight into a character's world if I know what they're eating and I know I can see them around a table.
As well as writing about food, you're also a professional chef.
I am.
Which I feel weird asking about, because
we do it together.
I know.
The podcast of nepotism.
Yeah. Absolutely. Tell me about my catering business, Kate.
Shall I tell you about your catering business?
How did you end up doing that?
So Liv and I met on... I'm looking at you and talking to you and, as if you're in third person. It's very strange.
It's easier that way.
It is easier. Liv and I met on Twitter at the end of 2015 when I was leaving work.
Just before the book deal.
And so we ended up just after I'd left my job and Liv was considering leaving hers and was thinking about what was going to be next. We had a coffee in East London that turned into sort of a 6-hour long coffee and then oysters and then cocktails and let's just hang out in East London and be best friends forever, please. And I was moving to open this cafe that was going to be up in Liverpool, and then I was back 2 months later and we caught up again and
we started hanging out.
We thought it was a sort of a really great first date that you then sadly leave the city and you always pine for that one relationship that
but
never
we got
worked
our
out.
Rom-com happy
yeah,
ending.
Exactly. But we got our rom-com happy ending, and I came back to London And you came round and we cooked a blood orange cake.
We did. From the, was it the Sherlock Holmes
From
one?
The Sherlock Holmes, yeah. Like the really, it's in the second book actually.
Okay.
And it was the five orange pips cake. It was really great. And we started talking about maybe doing a dinner together.
Just a supper club.
Just a supper club. And I was doing a Ferrante and Elena Ferrante supper in the London Review bookshop. Mm. And we did that. And then we planned a Gilmore Girls dinner together. And then the next year we started doing lots of different TV dinners and we started doing weddings. And now that's what we do. We started, we signed partnership papers at your hen do, I think.
I'd actually forgotten that, but yeah, I think you're right. Yeah,
that's
no,
what happened.
That does sound plausible.
So we now have a business partnership and we cater things together and mainly weddings and things. We obviously both also write. So what I love about it and what I wanted to do with it was I'm naturally relatively introverted, but I definitely miss the collegiate nature of working in a theatre and working towards a shared goal and being in an office full of people who are under pressure. Mm. I really like and thrive on that sort of stress and pressure that
and
I did
at
work.
How do you go about planning these dinners? I mean, what were you serving for the Ferrante dinner?
I did a sort of a Neapolitan feast. So Liv is very good at going, that's a stupid menu, don't be ridiculous.
But at that point, we didn't. This was very early on.
So I did a menu that involved us doing three very fiddly little things for each person,
for five courses. Yeah.
So we had arancini, and we had little ravioli, and we had grilled sardines and salads,
we had
shoe buns filled with pistachio cream.
And then something sweet.
It was enough. Like, I've learned a lot.
Well, I came on board to basically say, Kate, stop it. So that's my role.
That is our general relationship. But yes, it was very difficult to deliver on the day. But basically, I just wanted to create menus full of things I want to eat. Mm. And that has always been the theme. We write menus that we want to eat, that we would want to be at that wedding or be at that dinner and have those things in front of us. And lots of times we take either inspiration from the book or the TV show or whatever we're being inspired by itself, so a thing that the characters eat, but often it's, oh, we'll take where this book is set and food that would make sense in that place and that time and that space, because there's not always loads of mentions of specific dishes, but you have a sense of the space and the place through the writing.
And you talk about biological imperative of eating, but clearly cooking and eating for you is a real joy.
Oh gosh,
What is your ultimate comfort food?
I think bread. I just like bread more than anything else. I really like bread and I really like butter. And so either nice buttered, like hot buttered toast, but also just like bread and butter. I think there are some places where I want to go for dinner basically because I want to have the bread plate.
Noble Rot.
Yeah, I want to go there and eat the bread plate and have a couple of glasses of wine and then be like, shall we have anything else or should we just have another bread plate and maybe some olives? Yeah, I think that is the most comforting, wonderful thing. It also makes your house smell fantastic. If I have to name an actual dish, then it's roast chicken. But I think on a daily basis, bread and butter.
And then it would be roast chicken with bread and butter.
Roast chicken with bread and butter to dip. Yeah, exactly.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us. And Kate's new book, The Little Library Year, is out now, available in all good bookshops.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink Podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon ciel.